Aaron Copland.
Yes.
Of course. Beloved grandfather of American music.
And and a household name as well.
Yes.
So that's really nice. But okay, now why Aaron Copland?
Well, Aaron Copland is really responsible for creating, inventing many of the musical attributes that sound like American music. So if you're watching a commercial for beef or a movie where America is meant to be evoked in some abstract way, if it's not Copland's music that you're hearing in that beef commercial or in that American episode in the film, it's probably music that uses stylistic features that Copland devised.
Yeah, I agree with you, though. I think that, that anything that isn't Copland, that people try to throw in some Americana, is usually, they usually get their ideas.
Yeah, people often talk about that in terms of the sensation of space he gives, of sort of frontier in his music. Because he'll often have layers happening that are spread really far from one another in the pitch range. So something really low and something really high. So there's this vast empty space between the two voices that seems to evoke the frontier.
People, right.
Something American.
And some people consider him a modern music composer. Would you feel he was a modern music composer of that time?
Anyway? Right, Copland's a really interesting case because on the one hand, much of his music is so accessible and so actually overtly patriotic, right? There's Fanfare for the Common Man, and there's Lincoln Portrait, which takes excerpts from speeches by Abraham Lincoln, and they're recited in narration with music behind them. But he was also really interested, he trained with Nadia Boulanger in Paris.
A woman.
He's got his modernist credentials. He experimented with 12-tone music, but he never. His music always has this sort of sweep and grandeur and optimism, and often some kind of nationalism that you don't associate typically with really modernist kinds of composers. And so maybe now we can talk about the person that I think many American composers would identify as their biggest American influence, and that's Charles Ives.
Oh, yeah.
So Ives inspires sort of composer dedication in a way that very few other people do. Many of my composer friends can wax kind of rhapsodic about him for long periods of time.
Born at the end of the 19th century.
Yeah, and Ives, there's something special about his music. Even if you're not an aficionado and you're not a total Ives maniac, there's something really special about his music in that it mixes, often actually simultaneously, lots of vernacular kind of American musical influences. So you often have, you could have some sort of parade music layered on top of like a spiritual layered onto all these kinds of things you'd really be hearing in an American soundscape. So that Ives' music often sounds like just you're inside the head of this super smart, you know, sensitive person who's hearing all of these things and kind of interpreting them. And but it's off-putting at first, maybe, can be, because it's a bit of cacophony that arises when you have all of those set against one another at once.
A very experimental composer. I can't remember which piece it is, but there's a piece that reminds me of walking like into the music department and opening a door and somebody's playing something, you know, and then you walk down the hall, open another door and you hear something else. And for some reason, they're one of his pieces and I can't remember which one, but it reminds me of that.
Yeah, there's a lot of Ives that can give you that impression of sort of moving in space and hearing different kinds of musical genres as you're.
Now we have Aaron Copland and Charles Ives.
Yes.
On Mount Rushmore.
Right.
Picture it. Okay.
Okay, well, my next selection, I think a lot of people disagree with. I'm just going to put that out there.
Hey, this is your Mount Rushmore, Lisa.
I'm going to explain why.
Okay.
So I have selected John Adams.
Why do people disagree with John Adams? Why would people?
You know, I think the reception to his music, people often have strong opinions about him, and they can go in one direction or the other. But I think one of the things I was thinking about was that these other composers excelled really in more symphonic genres, and as Adams does. But also, Adams has uniquely contributed to the body of American opera.
Definitely. So Nixon
writing
in China.
Really significant, influential operas that are also on American themes. Dr. Atomic.
Yeah, that's what it's called. I was going to say, what's the one called? Oppenheimer. Dr. Atomic.
And I think opera is becoming increasingly relevant. I wanted to pick an American opera composer because of the live from the Metropolitan Opera broadcast.
Right.
That's really bringing opera in full color.
I think it's wonderful.
Yeah, to people who live all over the world, actually.
Would you call John Adams kind of post-minimalist instead of minimalist? Because he's a little younger than Philip Glass, right?
That's right. So he's not like an initiator in the way that Steve Reich or somebody would be. But he does certainly use minimalist techniques in his music. But he, similar to Copland in some ways, has this sort of romantic grandeur to his music that Reich and Glass, for example, lack generally. Often his symphonic music will come to some sort of rousing, percussion-aided climax that's really very effective, especially live.
I think probably one of his most well-known pieces is Short Ride in a Fast Machine.
Yeah, right.
And he also won a Pulitzer Prize.
Right. You know, that's for an interesting piece. It was something written after 9/11. And
right.
That's another sense in which he's been an important, distinctively American composer, is that he's sort of been the go-to guy in recent years for national sort of... the other one, it's, maybe this could be a runner-up for the John Adams place on Rushmore, would be Samuel Barber, whose Adagio for Strings has also been associated with those kinds of important national...
Of course. Okay, so we have now on Mount Rushmore, we have John Adams, Aaron Copland, and Charles Ives, which leads to Lisa's final choice. And this is definitely a household name, right?
Well, okay, my final choice is, I guess, a little idiosyncratic. I tried to pick him for objective reasons, like his use of expanded techniques on instruments and various other reasons. But really, I think probably fundamentally I'm picking him because I love his music. And his music was the first American music that I came to love when I was young. And this composer is George Crumb. He writes this music that's very... sometimes incorporates theatrical elements. You might have seen they've performed at the university many times over the years his Voice of the Whale, which involves performers, a flutist, a cellist, and a pianist wearing masks, whale-like masks, and performing in blue light. And often the performers have to do things like play inside the piano or whistle or utter kind of shrieks. he creates this really... amazing sound world, just very compelling. And when I was growing up, it was like 12 or 13, I will confess that I wrote him a piece of fan mail.
Really?
Yes, I did.
That's great.
Actually, it was probably like a long, embarrassing letter. That's probably what it was like. And he is known to be, he taught at the University of Pennsylvania for a long time and is known to be this really gracious, lovely man. And he wrote me back.
That's what I was going to ask.
Such a kind, wonderful, patient, supportive letter, which I promptly framed. And
I was
displayed
going to ask
in my bedroom
you, okay.
all the way throughout my
And
job.
You still have it, right?
I still have it.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Now,
then I met him later when I was in graduate school and considered confessing that probably I was the author of probably the dorkiest letter he ever received, but I decided to just...
Oh, you should have.
No, I think I shouldn't have.
Oh.
I'm glad I didn't.
He's still alive, isn't he? I know he retired like at the end of the 20th century sometime
around. He left Penn, but I think he's still at Arizona State.
Wow.
Sort of retired out there and does some. Yeah, he's still composing, he's been very influential for the generations of composers after him just by being this. I mean, he's a wonderful. You
avant-garde.
Can tell by the story about the letter, right? That he's this wonderful guy. In addition to writing really beautiful music and beautiful scores, by the way, also really works of art
and so experimental. Glass marbles poured onto an open piano. You know?
Yeah, but also very like often very accessible. So he has one piece where Chopin's Fantasy Impromptu kind of comes in this mysterious way and then moves out and really moody.
And
I'll note that I've really left some really significant people off this list. Obviously, I think people would probably argue most about the omission of, let's say, John Cage, Elliot Carter, George Gershwin, Leonard Bernstein. Those are probably the people that
Any women?
Well, I was going to say that another person that could certainly eventually be someone that people would want to include on such a list.
If we take someone off.
Well, okay. There's this wonderful composer called Augusta Reed Thomas.
Okay.
Who's just amazing. She was the composer in residence at the Chicago Symphony for a long time, and she has premieres coming up this spring with the Paris Orchestra, the National Symphony, and also the University of Arkansas student ensembles, because we are fortunate enough to have the McElroy family visiting professorship in the performing arts go to Augusta Reed Thomas this spring, and we've been able to commission a large, significant work from this very important composer that'll be premiered here at the Walden Arts Center in April.
Wow, April that'll 15th. Be wonderful. We'll talk more about that.
So that's our own Mount Rushmore candidate.
Lisa Margulis, Associate Professor of the Music Cognition Lab at the University of Arkansas, here with her four picks for great composers, great American composers, to take their place on Mount Rushmore.
PJ, thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. For Ozarks at Large, I'm PJ Hrabowski.